The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
From the Book of Serenity, Dongshan's No Grass. The pointer. Move and you bury your body 10,000 feet deep. Don't move, and sprouts grow right where you are. You must cast off both sides and let the middle go too. Then buy some sandals and travel some more before you really attain realization. The main case. Master Dongshan said to the assembly, "It's the beginning of autumn, the end of summer, and you all will go, some to the east, some west. You must go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. He also said, "But where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, how will you go?" Shishuang said, "Going out the gate, immediately there's grass." Dayang said, "I'd say, even not going out the gate, still the grass is boundless." Hongzhi's verse. Grass boundless, inside the gate, outside the gate, you see by yourself. To set foot in the forest of thorns is easy. To turn the body outside the luminous screen is hard. Look, look, how many kinds. For the while, going along with the old tree, with the same emaciation in the cold, about to follow the spring wind into the scars of the burning. The koan is a, as it's taken up in koan lineages, is a, I think, a rather extraordinary way of training. It's not for everybody. And it's not utterly unique in the sense of in Buddhism and in other traditions where a teacher would offer what we speak of as live words, words that are not explanatory. They're not imparting information and trying to educate the student, but are trying to actually precipitate something more seismic. In the koan lineages, the koan is taken up as a meditation practice itself, which means that the student is developing the capacity to hold language, which usually sets our mind in motion, and that language has meaning, which usually we get caught up in terms of the meaning that we that it has that we give to it, and then our mind sort of, you know, escalates from there into conceptual thinking. And that the function of the koan is to basically bring forth a deep inquiry into some essential aspect of our very existence and to bring illumination, to bring insight. That is, by its nature, non-conceptual. And so the student's mind has to move beyond a conceptual thinking basis and experience something directly. And that's why it can't be controlled. That's why it has to develop out of their meditation practice and their inquiry. That's why the language in the koans is using ordinary words, but oftentimes in unordinary ways. And there is, you know, I've talked about this before, where there are different kinds of teachings in Buddhism. There are teachings that are instructional. So when you come here and we give you instruction in Zazen, we each have received that. The first time I came, I had already been sitting on my own. I didn't think I knew everything, but I thought I knew enough. So that on the Sunday, first Sunday I came, and I after service, and they called people who were here for the first time to Zazen instruction, and I just sat on my seat. And the monitor came up and said, "Don't you need Zazen instruction?" I said, "No, I don't need that." And they let me get away with it. So I got it later. So there's instructional teaching. There's teaching that is not so much instruction in what to do, but in the teachings themselves, and so sort of on the, in the mando, that we did on Thursday. That was an example of that, talking about Dhanaparamita, compassion, in ways that, you know, has a linear aspect. We can understand what's being said and benefit from that. And then there's teachings that isn't like that, that is more direct, nonlinear, that requires a kind of leaping, of listening, of reflecting, of taking it in, of practicing it. And there are teachings that are sort of merging some of those different qualities. In one, Dogen is a good example of that. In one moment it may be very linear and understandable, in the next moment he leaps off. And that kind of teaching is more difficult, right? Because it's not instructional, it's not just linear. So we, you know, using language in ordinary ways to convey something that is understandable. And so there's much teaching that is important for practitioners to engage, which is going to be difficult. And sometimes it's difficult because it's very old and it's using language in a way that comes from that time and, you know, culture and use of language. It can be difficult because of the language itself. There's words that we have to actually understand. What does this mean? What is dependent origination? Even more simple seeming words like compassion, non-attachment, detachment, dispassion. These words that, left on our own, we can come to our own conclusions and might miss the mark. And so that's part of it, is that we have to actually develop understanding. The concepts themselves can be very difficult because they're talking about something at a very deep level. But the nature of mind, of consciousness, of existence, of karma. If these were easy to understand, then everybody would understand, right? And so it's just important to know, because there's a lot available in Buddhist literature these days that is very good teaching, very inspiring and encouraging, and in a way very accessible, and that's important. But it's for practitioners, I really urge all of us to not limit ourselves. You know, if something is difficult, particularly if it's something that's come down over hundreds of years, there's a reason it's come down to us. It's because it's been valued over those hundreds of years. It's been seen as being something important, if not essential. And so it merits our sustained effort, and that it will yield as we yield. And so this weekend in this introductory retreat, we've been spending time practicing and speaking to this noble path. In the pointer, when it says, move and you bury your body 10,000 feet deep. Don't move and sprouts grow right where you are. You must cast off both sides and then let the middle go. And so this is basically and very directly talking about our penchant for attachment. I see that I'm attaching to this, and it's like, okay, I'll let go of that just as soon as I've got a good grasp on this over here, right? It's like walking forward on a precarious path, handhold by handhold, and we don't let go of one till we've got the next one secure in our hands. And here he's saying, no, let go of everything all at once. Cast off every side. And then buy some sandals and travel some more. And so within a life, a society, a world, a humanity, in which attachments come very easily, right? We don't have to teach any human being to attach to things. It's something we just begin to do. But we can teach people to attach much more and be voracious and believe in it. And that's kind of what we're in the middle of in our time. And so all of this practice that we study and practice here is engaging this path of profound non-attachment within a world of attaching to things. And as it says in the commentary, this is something you must each see by yourself. No one can substitute for you. Right? There are no pinch hitters here. There's nobody that we can call. Can you do this for me? Could you do, I'll pay you to do my homework. And so to let go of what binds us. So what binds us? Well, for a practitioner, that's what we need to see. We need to see what is binding us. Buddhism is telling us all the time. But we need to see it for ourselves. What binds us? Basically anything we attach to. Remember that function, Nabhidharma teaches the function of attachment is to cause us to suffer. So why does attachment matter? What is attachment? When the eyes encounter a visual object, the ears encounter a sound, a perception is born and we cling to that perception and then we transform it into an idea that is based in long-held desires that leads us to believe in that object as something that exists outside of ourselves by its own power, its own being. And in that, it has the power to make me happy. It has the power to make me sad. And so we have attachments that strive to keep things away. We have attachments that strive to hold them close. When we hold on to something, we've already lost it. When we try and push something away, we just bind ourselves to it tighter. And that is something we have to see for ourselves. Because when we see it for ourselves, it becomes very personal. It's like all of the teachings about life and death can seem very distant and abstract until we're in the presence of death. Now it's not abstract anymore. That's why Buddhism keeps presenting us with these realities. Dongshan was one of the very important teachers in our lineage, 9th century. And here, so he's speaking at the end of their ango, which traditionally is done in summer, in winter. We do it in fall and spring, which is kind of wonderful. Because summer, everybody's on vacation, not conducive to ango. Winter, holiday seasons. Spring and fall are nice periods of time. So here he's saying it's the beginning of autumn, the end of summer, and all of you are going to go. You're leaving the monastery because ango's over, and you're going to be going back to your home temples or on pilgrimage, or this was the tradition. Some of you will go east, some will go west, but wherever you go, go where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles. And the footnote says, he's luring cats into a dry well. So the teachings, sometimes the teacher is referred to as a thief, who's trying to steal away all that we grasp. Although they can't actually do that. We can't take something from someone. We can't force someone to let go. We can take what they're holding on to out of their hand, but we haven't taken away their attachment. We might have just strengthened it. And so in a sense, it's talking about a spiritual luring cats into a dry well is not a pretty, image, but he's talking about a spiritual kind of death, a leaping into the death of attachment to a self, to a sense of self, to that which binds us. A master controller. Grass is often used in the teachings as a metaphor for delusions, right? It just proliferates. It comes in all kinds of varieties, thousands, thousands of species, right? And they're brilliant at what they do, which is they seed very quickly, they grow quickly, and they proliferate, and they regenerate. Sound familiar? And so grass here represents our delusions, the things we attach to, that which obstructs and hinders and causes us to be unhappy in all kinds of ways and to make others unhappy. And so he's saying, go to a place where there's no grass for 10,000 miles. Is there such a place? Is it heaven? Is it the top of a mountain or a deep cave, a desert island? Is it a monastery? I was thinking we should have a sign at the front gate so that when you come in, it says, it's all coming with you. You haven't left anything behind. And when you leave, there's a leaving sign. It's all coming with you. You haven't left it behind. I just came across a poem this morning by a Chan hermit, 14th century, named Stonehouse, who was also a teacher, but spent much of his life as a hermit, and sort of fortuitously came across this poem. He said, "Don't think a mountain home means you're free. A day doesn't pass without its cares. Old people steal my bamboo shoots. Boys lead oxen into the wheat. Grubs and beetles destroy my greens. Boars and squirrels eat up my rice. Things don't always go my way. What can I do but turn to myself?" I can't control all of this, he's saying. You might think that this mountain hermit hut would have been the final escape from the world, but the world just comes, and not just in the form of grubs and beetles and people stealing his food, but in the form of his own mind. So what is this place where there's no grass? Grass, weeds, or plants that grow where they're not wanted. They compete with cultivated plants, right? That's why in a garden we pull them. We choose to pull these plants to protect these plants, right? They're competing. Like our anger seems to compete with our compassion. Our greed can compete with our generosity, impatience with patience, doubt with insecurity, distraction with mindfulness. But where is the competition, in fact? Where is the conflict? It's like when you're playing a game or competing for a job. When I was applying for music school and competing with other applicants, going before a jury to play and hope I would be chosen. Artists applying for a grant, applying for a job. Is the competition in the ball, in the job, in the music, in the position, in the other person that I'm competing with? If I'm running a race and I want to win, and we're competing against each other, is the competition in the person next to me who might be getting ahead? It's my mind. And so we sit to study this mind, this restless, proliferating mind, this restless, unsettled body, this restless, agitating emotional state that comes and goes. And we find that it's like stepping into a beautiful pond, and we run back and forth, and it's wonderful, frolicking, and wonder why the pond is so muddy. The water is so cloudy, and that frustrates us. We begin to experience the weight of our thoughts. That's why I said on Friday night, distraction is not neutral. When our mind is wandering about painful things, about pleasant things, about planning things, about remembering things, the things themselves are whatever they are, but the action is not neutral. We are, in a sense, unconsciously training our mind to wander, to roam, to grasp, to attach. And that habit is so strong, which is why when we begin practicing Zazen, it's difficult for it not to keep happening, because that's, in a sense, what we've been unconsciously teaching our mind to do. But the mind has a natural capacity. Just like water has a natural capacity to be clear all the way through, so too does the mind. We just need to stop running. And so we notice that when we encounter something, we like it or we dislike it, we name it, give it a name, identify it, we think about it, and then just observe what happens now. It grows. It gets bigger. And not only does it grow, the sensation grow, but the self grows. When we relax the mind into its natural capacity to not react with liking and disliking, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate, liking and disliking, are absent, the way is clear and undisguised. And so Dongshan is saying that it's important to encounter that mind, that place where there's no grass, no movement, no stirring, no running, where there's no inch of grass for 1,000 miles, to meet our original mind, primordial mind, our uncreated mind, free of constraints and boundaries, worries. And this is not a mind that we have created. It is not a place in which things have been made absent. It's not that we finally swept everything out of the door and then shut it tight. Try that. Well, you probably already have. I'm just guessing. It doesn't work. That's the mind of samsara. When you try to stop activity to achieve peace, your very effort fills you with more activity. And so this mind, this Buddha mind, is not the result of any action. It is peaceful. Its very nature is peaceful. And it is the nature of all things, so all things have this same mind. But then Dongshan says, but where there's no grass for 1,000, 10,000 miles, how can you go? To realize this Dharma body, this Dharma, this Buddha mind, this place of no grass is a place of no body, no time, no space, no past, no present, no future. When we begin to recognize that in every moment when we are aware, when something is happening, when we're reacting, the self is present and is creating, is producing, is very active. And even if the mind is still, the deeper functioning, the deeper sense of self is still present and will still create a sense of subject and object. But in that encounter, that realization of that mind that is empty of grass, of person, a personhood. I was sitting with a couple of you at breakfast on Saturday morning, two of you who were involved in technology. We started talking about AI, and one of you was telling me that, telling me and the other person there that, you know, as AI grows further and further and, you know, is creating false realities and false things and false information and false people, false bodies, that there will be a way to prove personhood. Right? There will be a way to, we'll need to be able to prove that we're actually just a human being. And I was thinking, and my first thought was, well, just prove that we're deluded. Right? That should be easy. Right? But then I thought, well, but if AI is developing its knowledge base based on what we give it, then it's diluted too, right? So when there is no thing remaining, no grass, and how can you go? Dongshan is asking. So we practice to let go of all the things we actively cling to, and we arrive at the place where finally there's not a single thing. And then what is our first impulse? Hang on to that, baby. You worked hard for that. Don't let that go. There's a story of a student who came to realize this emptiness of mind and body. And the teacher could immediately see that they were clinging to it. And so they responded in a way to get them to step forward, having realized the death of the self. Now, come back to life. And the student said, it's quite endearing. The student said, couldn't I just stay here for a moment? Please. Very honest request. So Dongshan is asking, how could you go in this place? So when there is not a single thing, how do you let go of that? Well, not a single thing is just another idea. So realizing emptiness, if we're not careful, the next moment, the sense of the note, the experience, direct experience of emptiness becomes an object in our mind. And so that's why the pointer says, let go of every side and the middle. And now buy some sandals and travel some more. The Buddha said that the clinging, and especially to the sense of self, is the most persistent, the most tenacious. So don't be frustrated, right? Practitioners, when we see that arising, the strength of that arising again. And also recognize, as I often say, that the sense of self is just an aspect of our consciousness. Don't fight it. It's not anything but a sense of something. It's just a function of our mind. It's no more or less than any other thing that arises. It's just we grasp onto it and we impute into it all kinds of meaning, solidity, reality it doesn't actually possess. And then these other teachers comment on this. Because what Dongshan is saying is first, go to that place where there's no grasp. Free yourself of this body and mind, this attachment to this idea of self in every way that it appears. And then when you get to that place where nothing can be found for 10,000 miles, now come back to life. The image that's used is of climbing to the top of a mountain, and you reach it and the air is clear, it's pristine, it's gorgeous. You can hear distant cries from down below, but you're up here, beyond any place of worry or concern. And having traveled in mountain training up the mountain, how do you keep traveling when you're on the top of the mountain? Well, you go back down. And so this image, this metaphor of returning back down into the valley where all the action is, but now unencumbered by this sense of self, these attachments. And not just attachments of ourselves, but the attachments of others, the sense of self of others, because we realize those too are empty, even if others have not realized it. And so these other teachers have commented, and there are certain koans where you see that, where a certain dialogue that was recorded caught the fancy, you know, sort of, you know, other teachers liked that because they found it powerful, so they would comment on it. And so here, Shishuang, another teacher later, says, well, you know, going out the gate, already there's grass. So Dongshan says, where there's no grass, how can you go? And Shishuang says, as soon as you're out the gate, there's already grass. And people can hear this, as this is spoken of in the teachings in different ways, where they hear senior students or teachers talk about how they continue to practice and encounter attachments, the sense of self, and so on, and can come to a mistaken conclusion that none of this is really working. It never really goes away. You know, you just sort of adapt, you know, get better at letting go. But basically, you know, we're sort of screwed in the beginning, screwed in the middle, screwed in the end. You know, and that's it. So then why would we be doing this? For company and misery? You know? No. And yet it's just misunderstanding or misbelieving, you know, our capacity to be in control or to eradicate a delusion. What this koan is really pointing to is what is the nature of our obstructions? What is the nature of the things that bind us? Not just what are they, to be able to identify them. Well, there's stuff going on at work, and there's stuff going on at home, and there's stuff going on in the world. Yes, for sure. It's always been like that. Unless we actually fully realize the bodhisattva vow, which means everybody's crossed over, it will always be like that. That's samsara. And so the Dharma is not teaching us how to eradicate or get away from or get rid of the attachments. the grass, but to understand what it is. Where is the conflict? Where is the suffering? If it was in everything else, then it would make sense to do what we do. Just build a big wall, double lock the door, don't go out, because it's out there. But the Buddha realized that is not so. Yes, there's a whole lot going on that needs our attention, that does create suffering. Absolutely. And where does it create suffering? In the minds and bodies of people. And in which even the most innocent, it's hard to say it, but even the most innocent begin to participate in their own suffering. That is initiated not their fault, but now that it's arrived in their doorstep, in their mind, in their body, now the mind takes that up, takes that on, and begins to participate and continue. And so that's why in Zazen we turn around. Shi Tao said, turn around the light to shine within and come home. The vast, inconceivable source cannot be faced or turned away from. What is it that you cannot face and you cannot turn away from? It's not somewhere else. And so as soon as you go out the gate, Shi Shuang says, already there's grass. Well, you could say, well, it's just so turn back around and go back into the monastery. Well, Dayang says, I'd say not even going out the gate, the grass is already there. So trying to avoid it, they're making clear, is not a viable path. There's a story where when Dongshan was first setting out on hermitage, he came across a woman who was carrying water. And he said, can I have a little bit of water to drink? And she said, I won't stop you from drinking, but I have a question I have to ask you first. Tell me, how dirty is the water? And Dongshan looked at it and said, the water's not dirty at all. And the woman says, get out of here and stop contaminating my water. He said, the water's pure all the way through. Clean. No sand, no dust, no debris. She says, you don't see. Already the grass is boundless. In the Ehe Koroku, Dogen said, everyone without exception holds on to the jewel that glows in the night. Unless we turn the light around and shine it within, how can we hold the jewel close to us when we are lost in the outlying countryside? We should memorize that. It's like a mantra. If I don't turn the light around and shine that light clearly within and get to the nature, self-nature of this one, then how, when I'm traveling out into the outlying countryside, could I hold this close when I'm lost? Another student was leaving their teacher, and they were promising to continue to uphold their teachings. And the teacher says, I pray that you will live it. I pray that you will live it. Going out the gate, already there's grass. The footnote says, watch where you're going. And so Buddhism, there's teachings of meticulous effort, being attentive. And that's not anxious, right? It's not obsessive. It's meticulous. It's just attentive, careful, observant, aware. Not even going out the gate, still the grass is boundless. Commentary says, there's no place for you to escape. And that actually is the good news, right? Because if there's a place for you to escape, you got to find it. Where is it? Everything comes down to that. And we try. I think we do. in all manner of ways. And so when we finally understand for ourselves, because no one can substitute this for us, there is no escaping from this, then all of that energy that was looking, searching outside somewhere, all that light being shined somewhere else, now there's one place I need to turn it. So Pema Chodron has this wonderful book, The Wisdom of No Escape. When we really see this and know this, in a way it only makes sense now to go straight ahead and to find some way, whether it's Buddhism, meditation, some way to examine the creator, the destroyer. When we know that no one's coming to save us, that's just another version of the good news. Right? Because if somebody's coming to save you, you got to be there, ready. Right? You can't leave home. You might miss the call. And what if they miss you? Right? Your name was blurry on their list. Right? Santa Claus missed that house. When we realize no one is coming to save me, then we can actually truly begin practicing. And when we realize, oh, you don't need to be saved, then you've come home. And so what these teachers are really saying is, this is the day we have to practice. This situation, this encounter, this relationship, this mind, this piece of news, this election. Because these are the ones we get. This is what we got. And this is the one we are. The one that's on your cushion. So each and every one of us brings the most important person in our practice life to our very cushion. And in the Bodhisattva path, that aspiration, that desire, that hunger, right? That in some way, whether it's clear or not, whether it's strong or incipient, that brings us searching, brings us to the path, that aspiration, when it's bodhicitta, is that it's not just about me. It isn't. It can't be. Because what the Buddha realized is we are inextricably bound to each other. Even Stonehouse, living on top of a mountain as a hermit, was practicing for the welfare of all beings. And so then that becomes this great vow, this great motivation. And so that's why Hongzhi says, the grass boundless, inside the gate, outside the gate, see for yourself. We have to see. That's why the Buddha's first teaching, or the first noble truth, the reality that life is dukkha, that everything we experience has the seeds of our disappointment and dissatisfying, is so revolutionary. In a way, so clear and self-evident when we look. And had to be the first teaching. We have to see by ourselves. We have to see for ourselves. And then Hongzhi goes on to say, to set foot in the forest of thorns is easy. We're already there, right? But to turn the body outside the luminous screen is hard. To shift. So you can think of every moment when your awareness brings you to something that is binding. That's a moment in Buddhism, a precipitous moment of potential. We can shift back into karma, our habit patterns, and strengthen that, or we can turn the screen, the body outside the luminous screen, and realize it's much larger. This thought, this emotion, this bondage is not what it appears to be, but I have to see that. And in seeing that, it's not the same. And in not being the same, it doesn't have power. And so he says, look. How many kinds? Footnote says, tasks cannot be done too carefully. you know, meticulous effort. Sometimes what can be very helpful when you realize you're just moving, you know, and kind of barreling through, the mind is in such a state, it's just consciously take it down one notch. We can do that. We can just actually move just one notch slower. So in a way, it's sort of controlling, exerting a little bit of control to just slow down a little bit and just see what the effect is that that might have on the mind. You know, it's sort of like when you're in a bit of a panic and you move forward and then it increases your panic and then you go faster. Go the other way. How many kinds, says. The Buddha Dharma is basically saying we're in the midst of just innumerable streams, a day filled with innumerable moments. And when we practice mindfulness, we encounter them, we see them, we experience them. To go out on a day like this that is unimaginably glorious, there's so much ki outside the door. And to miss that. It's like the earth is giving us this gift. It's shouting, hallelujah! And we can miss that. And if we miss that, then we're going to miss much more subtle things. All the many kinds. And then he concludes, for the while, go along with the old tree, the old wise tree, who stands stable and sees it all happening and meets it all within that stability and comes and goes, grows its leaves, sheds its leaves, branches break off, periods of drought, periods of flood, periods of flourishing, and it stands. Go along with the old tree, with the same emaciation in the cold, not accumulating, shedding, so that we can follow the spring wind into the scars of the burning. It's one of my favorite lines in the whole wide world. To follow the spring wind into the scars of the burning. That's the courage that the Bodhisattva, we cultivate, a fearlessness. And when we're afraid and anxious, just bring it with you. Right? It's okay. It's okay. It's just an emotion. Just don't let it overwhelm. Just don't let it control. Don't give it that control. And that's why it's said that the Bodhisattva is not afraid when they realize how long this path is. They realize it. They just don't worry about it. They're not afraid of how much suffering there is in the world. They see it, they feel it, because the defenses are falling down. The heart is growing large. And because of not clinging, we can do that. And they are fearless in the face of how many beings there are. And what's so beautiful about that is that the Bodhisattva sees all of that, right? And just, okay, that's my Buddha field. That's my place of practice. That's my world. That's our world. And so the footnotes to those last lines say, just keep today's determination. And so establishing an intention, establishing, having a sense of what is actually important. There are many things that are important. This here, this here, this here. Is there anything that underlies all of that? A kind of unifying principle, if you will, something that is present in everything. A kind of force or an intention or motivation that is kind of the driving imperative. Keep that determination. And he says, and you'll surely have a time of fulfillment. Because that will keep leading us forward into what is good and true. So to all those of you who have come for the weekend, it was very nice to have you with us. Thanks for coming and sharing yourselves with us and practicing together. I hope it was helpful. And whatever direction you take, give it your heart. Make it matter. When I see anyone come here, what I see is someone who in some way is recognizing that their life matters. They may not know that yet. That their life has consequence. They may not know that yet. I'll end with a poem, Master Wu Men, that came to mind this morning. Hundreds of flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, and snow in winter. If there is no vain cloud in your mind, for you, this is a good season.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.